Skuld and Utna emerged from the decorative fountain in the middle of the entire state building's 275th floor observation deck, alighted soundlessly on the tiled floor of the central gallery, and looked furtively around. Utna, as she always did when she tried to do stealthy things, felt vaguely comical, dressed all in black with her hair hidden under a watch cap. Skuld looked a little more comfortable, though the black cycling leathers she'd donned for the occasion did creak a bit more than she would have liked. Quickly they took stock of their situation. The deck was still closed, as they had expected. Its shops darkened, the elevator bank shut down. There were no guards posted in the area itself, though. They would be posted at the access points. The technicians had finished their fruitless work for the day, leaving behind only yellow tape cordons and the occasional piece of deactivated scanning equipment to indicate that their job was not yet done. "Okay," said Skuld softly. "This is perfect. If my theory is right, it won't take me long to prove it." "What do I do?" Utrina wondered. "Nothing," Skuld replied. "You're just here for moral support." "Oh. Come on. The closer I am to the center, the easier this will be." They went to the big mosaic compass rose that was built into the floor of the center of the observation deck. Skuld smiled. It was already a pretty decent magic circle, then switched in the marker tip on the handle of Bjarnil, her all-purpose mallet, and began adding a few embellishments to it. "Won't the crime scene guys notice that tomorrow?" Utrina wondered. "It disappears when energized," Skuld replied. "It's only necessary to start the reaction." "Oh. What was that?" "What was what?" "I thought I heard something." Skuld paused in her marking and listened. "I don't hear anything." "I could swear I heard something over by the Cinnabon," Utrina said. "You keep working. I'll go check it out. That's the last thing we need, is for some beat cop to wander up here." Skuld nodded and returned to her calculating and mapping. Utrina prowled off through the shadows into the observation deck's food court, her right hand holding the Thorn of the Roses rigging quiet and steady, left hand held open in front of her, ready to draw or defend or grab, depending on the circumstances. Nothing here. Maybe it had just been her imagination? This place was a little creepy at night, with everything shut down like this. She returned to the compass and was about to tell Skuld that it had been a false alarm when she heard it again, a very faint rustling noise, like cloth in a light breeze. She looked around, saw nothing, and then had the notion to look up. "Hey," she hissed to Skuld, "there's somebody up in the dome rigging." Skuld paused again, looked up, and said in a quietly urgent tone, "Are you sure?" "I just saw him," said Utrina, "hiding behind that beam," she added, pointing. "Okay, pal, come on out," she declared in a louder voice. "You're not a cop, or you wouldn't be hiding." For a moment, nothing happened. Then a voice, a familiar one, said, "Curses!" And a tall, slim figure dropped down from the beam. Skuld switched on her hand beacon and illuminated him. He was not just tall, but very tall, and dressed mostly in purple. In fact, his costume looked suspiciously like Martin Rose's hammer togs, except that this fellow wore neither hat nor scarf. Instead, he had a colorful sash belted around the waist of his jacket, and a domino mask covering his eyes, and his ruff of medium brown hair jutted up heroically. Skuld's shoulders slumped in mingled relief and exasperation. "Marty, what the hell are you doing here?" she demanded in a stage whisper. "I thought you were off this case." The masked man looked taken aback. "Marty?" he asked with an air of exaggerated innocence. "I'm afraid you're mistaken. Chief Inspector Rose is down at the docks chasing leads on Big Fire, just as his lawful orders bind him to do." Utrina put her hands on her hips and cocked her head in an attractively dubious fashion. "Uh-huh," she said. "And that makes you..." The masked stranger drew himself up grandly and announced, "You may call me Mister." Skuld threw up her hands. "Oh, this is just 20 shades of wrong," she said, and went back to work on the magic circle. Martin Rose glanced from one woman to the other and back again with a vainly hopeful bombing comedian's grin, then whipped off the mask, put on his hat. "Where'd he get it?" Utna wondered, and said in his normal voice, "Well, I had to try. Can I ask what brings the two of you to break into this sealed crime scene I was breaking into?" "I'm trying to find out what happened to those three girls, of course," Skuld replied. "Abducted by a Hutt syndicate, indeed." Rose nodded. "Hmm," he said. "Does seem a bit far-fetched. But then, Sergeant Hanneman would probably think what you're doing is fetched a bit farther." Skuld grinned, finished her circle, and went to the center. "Probably," she agreed. "That's the trouble with cops," she added impishly. "No imagination." Then she closed her eyes, her brand glowed, and she began to chant. "Eddies in space-time, disturbances in the ether, be ye revealed to the gaze of tomorrow. Let the path which the missing took be shown to my eyes. Portal trace!" The circle glowed, hummed, then sizzled out of existence, leaving no trace that there had ever been markings on the floor. Other than that, nothing much appeared to happen. "That's very odd," said Skuld, opening her eyes. "Did you see anything?" Utna asked. "Yes," Skuld replied pensively, "but I'm not sure what it was. It was a magical signature unlike anything I've ever detected before. Alien enough that I couldn't tell where they were taken, only that they were taken magically." Utna hummed thoughtfully and looked down at the shinily polished marble floor. For a moment, in the reflection of one of the dim night-shift lights shining down from the dome beams, she saw the very worried, not at all puzzled, face of Dios. He didn't have to manifest more fully than that, or speak, or make any gesture. The look on his face told her everything she needed to know. "Oh my," she said softly. "Hmm?" asked Hammer. "They're in Sephiro," Utna murmured. Umi Ryuzaki had always had a sneaking suspicion that she would go mad someday. That sort of thing, she had been told, ran in families, and her parents were quite insane, so Umi, as humans insisted on mispronouncing her name, had expected that her time would come. She had hoped she might get the chance to at least reach adulthood before her grasp on reality snapped, but it appeared that was not to be. In fact, it seemed, to her consternation, that the form her madness took was very different from that suffered by her parents. They had only been possessed by a bizarre desire to leave Hyrule and settle in teeming, bustling New Avalon, hurling themselves and their hapless only daughter headlong into the fast-paced life of the inner galaxy. They lived in that strange city, parsecs from home, and thrived there, her father reveling in the high-pressure world of investment banking, her mother the very picture of the modern cosmopolitan housewife, acting more human than the humans. Umi had often thought, when she caught herself enjoying life in New Avalon, that she was looking down the barrel of the same derangement, but to her dismay she seemed instead to have become downright delusional. That was, paradoxically, the only rational explanation for the situation she now found herself in, wearing peculiar armor over her Fontainebleau Academy uniform, trekking through a world far stranger than New Avalon in the company of two girls from other schools. Weirder still, the girls were strangers to her, complete unknowns, and the world, though very strange, was actually in some ways curiously like home. More like Hyrule, certainly, than New Avalon. Hyrule didn't have islands floating in the sky, admittedly, but... She sat down on a rock and surveyed her traveling companions glumly. The human girl seemed decent enough, level-headed anyway, and smart enough to pronounce Umi's name correctly, which was rare in a human. Most of them not only said it wrong, but didn't realize they were doing so. She was entirely too phlegmatic about the situation, though, taking everything she saw with a practical air and trying to work within the constraints of the hallucination, rather than find a way out of it. The little red-headed Seleucian, on the other hand, was really starting to get on Umi's nerves. Not only couldn't she pronounce Hylian or hear that she was pronouncing it wrong, she was taking everything around them at face value. Too naive or too dumb to realize that the whole thing had to be some kind of delusion. She seemed positively sanguine about the whole mess, gleefully accepting the holographic midget's pronouncement that they had to become magic knights and save the world, whatever world it happened to be. Also, the redhead liked the useless little fuzzy thing that had been foisted on them by that crazy blonde woman in the creepy forest. The thing drove Umi crazy, with its constant chipper attitude, its chirpy voice, and its habit of blundering mindlessly into trouble. It was a perfect companion for red-headed Hikaru Shido, who had all the same habits. Umi wanted to strangle them both on at least an hourly basis, a desire made more complicated by the fact that Mokona didn't have a neck. Now Hikaru turned around and said, "Come on, Umi. We've still got an hour or two of daylight left. Let's keep moving. The sooner we get to Shalhara, the sooner we can save the world and go home." Umi glared at the little redhead, but that didn't seem to faze Hikaru any, and now Mokona was hopping around, chanting its repetitive syllable in enthusiastic, if inarticulate, agreement with her. "Miss Hikaru does have a point, Miss Umi," said Fu Hōji diplomatically. "Given the noticeable instability of this world, I do think it behooves us to lay on all practical speed." Umi shifted her glare to the honey-blonde human, but couldn't sustain it. Fu was just too gentle for Umi to feel justified in giving her a harsh look. Besides, she was right. That was the damnable thing about Fu. She was always right. Her play-along-with-the-delusion strategy seemed to be working for her. The Hylian sighed and got back to her feet. "Fine," she said. "But we're stopping at dark. I'm not trying to fight my way through another swarm of those bug things." "I agree completely," Fu assured her. "We'd better find some place to make camp," said Nol. "I'm not trying to fight my way through another swarm of those bug things." Corwin nodded. "There's a town just up ahead. I saw it from the last ridge. We should make it there before dark." He shifted his satchel shoulder strap and muttered, "I just hope this one's got someone who knows something in it." "Yeah," Noel mused. "I've been thinking about that. Doesn't seem like the way Baldur said it was, does it? This world has magic, that's obvious just being here, but the people don't seem to believe in it the way Baldur said they did." "Hmm," said Corwin thoughtfully. "It does seem that way, doesn't it? Baldur and Frey both said this place had a thriving sorceress tradition, but it seems to me that the common people are living in a weird mix of medieval ignorance and modern denial." "Yeah," repeated Nol. "Did you see the way those guys in the pub reacted to your markings? I'd say they still respect sorcerers, all right, but most of them fear them, too." Corwin scratched at his chin, pensive. "It's as if the world's evolved to keep vaguely in step with Midgard. Telephones, trains, and so on. And the modern people don't know how to deal with the fact that magic still exists. You see it in Midgard sometimes, too, but not nearly on this scale. Makes me wonder if maybe the people losing their faith in magic is what's making the world fall apart?" "Partly," Corwin replied. "I think I know what the main cause is," he continued darkly. "Stay focused, Rocket Boy," Nol cautioned him. "Remember what we talked about." "Relax, Nol. I'm not going to go dashing off on a search for Otori Academy. Not yet. I know the order I have to do these things in. Just so long as you keep knowing it, Noll replied. You go off half-cocked trying to keep your promise to Utrina first, you'll screw up everything for yourself and her.
I know, Corwin said, sighing. You don't have to convince me of this, Noll. I'm already aware of it.
Besides, knowing what I know about Otori, I'm not convinced I could handle him before finishing my trial. Relax. I've got it under control. Get the evidence I need to satisfy the council, ascend, then go after the bastard.
He shifted his pack again.
Anyway, with any luck, we'll run across Anthe out here someplace along the way. Then we won't have to deal with the Academy. I mean, it's a sure bet she didn't go back there anyway.
Not willingly, Noll agreed.
You're a sweet little sunbeam today, Corwin grumbled. Anyway, I'm still trying to fit what Balder and Frey told us into what I already knew, and I don't much like the picture I'm getting.
Me neither, Noll admitted, sighing. I hope the hell I'm wrong, but I'm starting to get the feeling we'll be dealing with him whether we want to or not.
This is a waste of time, said Kyuichi Sionji testily. He adjusted his grip on the shinai he held, shuffled his feet slightly on the bare wood of the Otori Academy Kendo Dojo, and glared at the smirking face of Toga Kiryu.
Oh, come, Kyuichi, Toga replied. We haven't done this in ages.
He moved the tip of his own shinai in little circles, waiting.
That's because it's a waste of time, Sionji told him.
Toga tisked.
Our public is watching, he said, indicating the horde of underclass girls who had gathered around the edges of the dojo to watch.
They haven't had a chance to see either of us in months. You can't disappoint them now.
Sionji scowled. We have more important things to do than play children's games.
Oh, yes, said Toga with a sardonic gesture. I forgot. You're the one true guardian of the Rose Bride now. Give it a rest already. She's not going anywhere with Nanami to look after her. Now, come on. Humor your oldest friend, After all, the redhead said with a mocking smile, I have to see if you've really got what it takes to guard Himemia. Who knows what happened to your skills wandering around out there in the wasteland?
Sionji's violet eyes narrowed. Then, slowly, dangerously, he smiled.
All right, he said. Fine. Then he raised his shinai into the ready position and waited.
Toga smirked a little bit and waited himself. Sionji always broke and struck first when they sparred according to strict kendo rules. Always. He didn't have the patience, the mental equilibrium. Just being smirked at by Toga was enough to goad him into making the first move. And when that happened, he always, always lost.
So, why wasn't he moving?
He was just standing there with that cold little smile on his face.
Silent. Unmoving.
His eyes steady on Toga's. Boring into the red-headed duelist like drills.
Not wavering, not even blinking. Then, suddenly, his pupils contracted, shrinking in a heartbeat to the tiny points of madness that so often characterized him at his moments of greatest stupidity.
Toga sneered internally, that was more like it, and moved to counter-strike. Only a half-second later, hearing the audience gasp, did he realize that Sionji hadn't moved yet.
"Damn it!" he snarled, backpedaling.
Sionji's strike barely missed his head. Toga dug in his heel and advanced again. Apparently this wouldn't be over in seconds like most of their classes. Sionji had gotten wilier, or perhaps his madness had just taken a new direction, one Toga hadn't been prepared to anticipate. They went back and forth for some time, the cheers of their audience getting louder and more partisan as the battle went on. Toga's consternation grew as he and Sayonji fenced back and forth across the dojo floor. The green-haired duelist's technique was different, familiar but changed, and it was more difficult for Toga to adapt than he had anticipated. Sayonji's control problems were conspicuously absent. He moved with an economy of motion that Toga found quite unnerving, and his face was completely placid as he and his erstwhile friend traded blows. He still didn't seem to be good enough to get the advantage of Toga, but neither did he throw the fight away like he always used to. It was going to take work to wear him down. Toga settled into the rhythm, biding his time, waiting for an opening. His confidence was unshaken by this odd change in Sayonji. He was still completely certain that he could beat his old friend. It would just take an adjustment to his tactics. Then, just as Toga had anticipated, Sayonji slipped up. He got a little bit impatient, left himself too far to the outside on a parry, and Toga, with contemptuous ease, disarmed him, sending his bamboo practice sword clattering into the corner of the dojo. Then he leveled the leather-padded tip of his own shinai at Sayonji's throat and grinned. "Looks like I win again," he said. "Your form is still slop." Sayonji exploded. His pupils vanished again, and with a battle cry that almost shook the rafters, the green-haired young man seemed almost to disappear, so fast did he move. He lunged forward, seizing the blade of Toga's shinai in his left hand, a maneuver that would have earned him a painful cut, but not a fatal one, had it been a real sword, and hauling it toward him across his chest. Toga, startled, kept his grip on the weapon at the expense of being pulled forward a half-step, straight into Sayonji's upthrust right elbow. The gasp of the onlookers merged with the smack of Sayonji's elbow into Toga's nose, and then the red-headed duelist was falling backward, sprawling on his back, blood staining his white gi jacket. Sayonji whirled Toga's lost shinai into his hand, took a lunging step, and whacked Toga stingingly in the forehead with its leather tip before the former student council president could fully hit the floor. Toga stared up at his ex-best friend in utter disbelief for several seconds before he managed to sputter, "That was an illegal move, you bastard!" Sayonji discarded the shinai with a negligent gesture and replied contemptuously, "Idiot. This isn't a fucking game anymore, Toga. There are no illegal moves in war." "Well said, Kyuichi," said a calm, mildly sarcastic voice from the doorway. The observers, some of whom were hovering in an agony of indecision, not knowing whether to rush to President Kiryu's aid or wait and see his, sure to be magnificent, revenge for this slight, gasped and drew back to admit Deputy Chairman Akio Otori to the dojo. "Get yourself cleaned up, Toga," said Akio with an easy grin, apparently unfazed by his chief minion's condition. "You'll be replacing Kyuichi as Nanami's relief." Toga got to his feet, dabbing experimentally at his nose. "Why?" he asked suspiciously. "Because I have another job for him," Akio replied breezily. "I'll tell you all about it later. For now, you'd best go get cleaned up and then send your dear sister off to bed. She's been on duty for almost 20 hours. Toga looked for a moment like he might protest. Then he squared himself up, bowed to the deputy chairman, and left the dojo, too preoccupied to respond to the squeals and coos of his admirers as he pushed his way through them. Sayonji gave Akio a suspicious look of his own. "Another job?" he said caustically. "I'm not your lackey, Otori. I'm here for her, and only her." Akio smiled. "Well, all right then," he said. "She has another job for you. Walk with me for a moment, and I'll tell you about it." Still looking suspicious, it was his job after all, mustn't make the bastard think it was too easy, Sionji collected his walking stick from its place by the door, then fell into step, following the deputy chairman's lead out the side door of the dojo and into the academy's apple orchard. 3 girls have just arrived in Sephiro from another world, Akio told him conversationally, once they were out of earshot of the now dispersing crowd around the dojo. Sionji raised an eyebrow. Another world? He inquired, careful to keep his voice as dubious as possible. Hmm, said Akio, nodding. They've been summoned according to an ancient prophecy. Their mission is to revive the ancient rune gods and bring them here to participate in the final culmination of the grand tournament. But there are forces trying to stop them. What forces? Asked Sionji. The Rose Knight, Akio replied gravely. Oh, not personally. She's still hiding, marshaling her power for her next attempt at wresting my sister away from me. But she has agents scattered throughout Sephiro, pawns and patsies who will do her bidding and attempt to stop the other rune knights from accomplishing their holy mission. If those pawns aren't stopped, if they succeed in thwarting the rune knights, then Anthe will never be free of the Rose Knight's curse. You wouldn't want that to happen, would you, Kyuichi? Sionji clenched his fists on the black-stained wood of his walking stick. No, he said, his face ashen. I wouldn't, I certainly wouldn't, no. What can I do to stop them? My sources tell me, Akio replied, that the fledgling rune knights are in Transvaar. If they know anything about what they're doing, odds are they'll make for Shalara first. That's where the rune god of the storm makes his lair. I want you... Sionji narrowed his eyes. Anthe wants you, Akio corrected himself smoothly, on the next train to Varia. See if you can find the knights, then keep an eye on them. Don't help them too much, they're supposed to have a hard time of it. It'll temper them so that they can awaken the rune gods, but make sure they don't get in over their heads. Sionji considered this, then scowled at the chairman. I want to hear this from her, he said. Why, Kyuichi, don't you trust me? Asked Akio with a broad grin. The green-haired duelist felt very proud of himself for his self-restraint as he replied only, No. 2 days later, Sionji got off the train in Varia. Feeling extremely dissatisfied, he hated to leave Anthe alone in that bastard's hands. He'd sooner have left his right arm. But in the maddeningly vague dialogue they'd been able to have, she'd managed to relate to him that she felt the mission Akio was sending him on was important, for different reasons. She couldn't relate what those reasons were, so Sionji just had to trust her. But trusting her came much more easily to him than trusting Akio. And so, hating every moment of it, here he was in Varia. Discreet inquiries indicated that the rune knights had passed through only the day before, heading toward Shalara. He shouldered his duffel bag and, walking stick in hand, remembering with dark amusement Akio's mocking, rather pitying look when he'd insisted that the stick was the only weapon he needed anymore, made for the city's west gate himself. Perhaps he could catch up to them if they dallied along the way or paused for dinner. The knights hadn't paused for dinner, and what they were doing instead certainly couldn't be called dallying. But they had stopped along the track to Shalara, all the same. What had stopped them was not laziness, fatigue, or hunger, but rather a pack of what appeared to be wild boars.
"What is with all the Jotatan monsters in this place?"
Umi Ryuzaki complained as she dodged one of them and chopped at it, with the long, ornate rapier that the Master Smith had claimed would be the only weapon she'd ever need.
"Must be an indicator that the pillar is in trouble," replied Hikaru. "Her prayers can't keep the monsters in check anymore."
"Well, it's damned sloppy of her," Umi snarled.
If she can't pay better attention than this to her job, maybe she should be replaced.
Miss Umi, Fu objected gently as she neatly decapitated a lunging boar. It's really not wise to joke about such things.
Heads up, rune knights, Hikaru cried. More of them coming in.
This happened 2 or 3 times a day, the knights had noticed, and they were getting pretty tired of it, the monstrous animals coming out of the woodwork and attacking them for no reason. And not always animals, either. Before Varia, they'd run afoul of what seemed to be a carnivorous fig tree, of all things, that Hikaru had ended up burning down with her fire magic. As usual, Makona abandoned them as soon as the battle began, hiding under a nearby bush and trembling. Disgustingly useless creature. Its only function, as far as Umi could determine, was to summon the weird egg-like building they camped in every night, and banish it again in the morning. And surely one of them could have been trained to do that, if the magic midget had cared enough to even show up in person to brief them on their mission. What a disappointingly stupid delusion this was turning out to be. Umi was a little disgusted with herself. She couldn't even go insane entertainingly. You would think a deranged fantasy world would at least be fun. She blasted another of the boars with the water dragon spell she'd learned, then turned to check on Fu. The golden-haired girl hadn't received any offensive magic yet, and though her healing abilities were always useful after these fights, her lack of mystic striking power meant that she always had to work the hardest in combat just to stay alive. It was, therefore, probably fortunate that she had the largest sword of the group, and that, before they'd acquired these blades, she'd had a magic bow, which she could still summon if the need arose. Her 2 weapons to the other knights, 1 apiece, gave her more flexibility in battle, and for all her bookish, polite exterior, she certainly wasn't lacking in courage. The chaos of combat, how many of these things were there? Left Umi no more time to observe her fellows. She could only hope they were doing all right as she battled to keep herself in one piece against the onslaught of the horde of boars. Hikaru Shido's bellowed battle cries rang in her ears, but from Fu there was always very little chatter in a fight. Truth be told, Fu was just considering yelling for help. Not that, with her teammates fully engaged as well, she expected it to do any good, when a white and green shape suddenly came out of the trees near her and laid out one of the charging boars with a heavy wooden thwack. The figure, tall and lean, twisted with great agility away from his first victim and crashed his weapon, which appeared to be little more than a length of dark-stained wood, across a second boar's skull, smashing it. Then he whirled to face Fu, and she gasped, because she knew him.
"Mr. Sai..." she began to blurt, but Kyuichi Sionji's eyes flashed warning at her, and he placed a finger to his lips for a moment before turning and helping her deal with another of her attackers. A moment later they were back to back, and he murmured over his shoulder, "It's absolutely critical that you don't recognize me. I've no time to explain. Do you understand?"
"Right," Fu replied, and they sprang apart, renewing attacks in different directions. She didn't really understand, but given what he'd just said, she didn't really need to. He was Caitlin Hutchins's student, Corwin's friend Utrina's classmate. If he said it was important that she didn't recognize him, then she wouldn't. But where in the world had he come from? How had he come to be in Sephiro? Was he also a rune knight? Neither the Master Mage nor the Master Smith had mentioned more than 3 in this particular prophecy. What would he be the knight of? Fu didn't know enough about Sephirian mythology to know how many more sorcerous elements the local traditions contained. There were so many things she wished Clef had had the time to tell them. Whichever, Sionji's presence in the center gave the knights a point to converge around, and they regrouped, handily dealing with their remaining adversaries. In a few more moments it was all over. Then, without a word, he smiled at them, turned and vanished into the woods.
"Hey!" Hikaru cried. "Come back here! Who are—"
She ran after him, but when she rounded the tree he'd stepped behind, he wasn't there.
You.
Wonderful, grumbled Umi, plopping herself down on a tree stump. More bizarre, mysterious figures.
Well, that wasn't a total bust, Corwin remarked to Nall as the two adventurers headed past the west gate of Varia. Sounds sure that the three mysterious girls were heading this way. They must be bound for Shalara, you think?
It's the only thing out this way, Nall replied, unless they're after something in the hills before the desert's edge.
Doesn't seem likely.
I hope this isn't a wild goose chase. That old monk wasn't very clear, and you know I never trust prophecies.
Corwin's mouth quirked in a little smile as he replied, Well, me neither, but they're obviously important. And if they're really from another world, and summoned here because of something to do with the pillar, I don't see how we can not check it out.
No, me neither, Nall agreed. I just hope we're not wasting our time, is all.
Well, we'll find out when we catch up, I suppose.
I suppose.
The Rune Knights made good time the next couple of days. Fu didn't let on to the others that she knew who the mysterious stranger had been when he came up in their discussions. They didn't see him again. They had no way of knowing it, but he'd returned to Otori Academy to report on his first encounter with them, and would be going ahead to Shalara to pick up their trail there, if he could. On Thursday the 9th, Utrina and Skuld's daily distraction, as they'd taken to calling their efforts at getting out of the house and keeping active through their semi-vigil, was a full-bore, no-holds-barred, quite illegal road race to a seashore resort town on motorcycles borrowed from Uncle Keiichi's collection. Skuld had selected a shining example of modern motorcycle technology, a Genom Dominator 1250 Fusion Tourer. Utrina, more of a traditionalist, chose to test her skill at two-wheeling, with which she was less comfortable yet than her automobile prowess, astride a classic 22nd century Yamazaki Razor, turbo-electric racer. When they got back, it was nearly dark. Laughing and talking, they returned the well-used machines to their owner, thanked him glowingly for the loan, and then went back to Skuld's cottage to shower, change out of their thermosuits, and get ready for dinner. A knock at the door heralded the arrival of unexpected company, which turned out to be the uniformed shape of Corwin's father, IPO Space Force Captain Benjamin Hutchins, better known to his friends, and certainly to his eldest daughter's roommate, as Griffin. "Just passing through the sector on an extended patrol," he said unconvincingly. "Am I intruding?"
"No, of course not," said Skuld, welcoming her one-time lover and close friend with open arms. "You're just in time for dinner, assuming you cook it," she added with an impish grin.
Griffin chuckled. "Well, all right," he said. "Got any chicken? I can do a passable bake-up with some cornflakes." One quick trip to the corner store later, he made them dinner. Their dinner conversation was light, pleasant, and didn't touch on the reasons for Utrina and Skuld's vigil. Afterward, as they were getting ready to leave the kitchen, Skuld drew him aside. "While you're here," she said, nodding toward Utrina as the pink-haired duelist, out of earshot, left through the archway to the living room, "maybe you should ask Utrina about your special project." Griffin looked a bit dubious. "Are you sure this is the time for that? I mean, she's got a lot on her mind."
"Exactly," said Skuld. "It'll take her mind off it for a bit. And mine. And yours."
Griffin weighed that for a second, then nodded.
"Yeah," he said.
"I guess you might have a point there."
Then he got up from the table and, followed by the smiling Norn, went into the living room.
Utrina looked up from the book she was reading and smiled. It was a little strained, but only a little. She really was pleased to see him tonight. It's just that there was somebody else. Well, let's be honest, quite a number of somebody else's. She'd have been more pleased to see. He knew the feeling and didn't grudge it to her.
"How you holding up?" he asked, sitting down in the armchair at right angles to her couch. Skuld plumped down next to her, opposite him.
"Decent so far," Utrinur replied, then smiled sheepishly. "Waiting is one of the things I'm worst at. Ask anybody who knows me."
Griffin nodded, grinning.
"I hear you.
Well, listen, while I'm here, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. I was going to bring it up after C-term finals, but that got kind of discombobulated."
Utrinur nodded.
"Shoot,"